You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
We could have buried it, but my dad somehow put it in a freezer bag and it's in the garage. I don't know why.
This is Archaeo Animals, and it's episode 6, and today we'll be talking about cows. I'm Alice Fitzpatrick, and with me as always is...
Simona Falanga, the one that's fun at parties.
You are fun at parties, even though I haven't been to a party with you.
Or anywhere, really.
No, yeah. The true tragedy of this podcast is that we actually haven't met in person yet.
Well, like when we eventually meet in May next year, we should probably like do a live stream or something.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so this is our cow episode. I know everyone is so excited to hear about cows. But more importantly, to kind of slightly date us recording this, let's first talk about that big cow.
Knickers.
Knickers the cow. So if anyone's listening in the future and people have already forgotten about this big cow, we will put a link to the story in the show notes. But it's extremely big cow. And it's just so nuts that this happened like right while we were recording our cow episode.
Yeah, because he's about 1.94 meters tall, isn't he?
Something like that, yeah.
And of course, yeah, we should mention that. Yeah, it's more than a cow per se. It's actually a steer, so a castrated male. Still pretty big boy.
Oh my god, it's an absolute unit. I remember like seeing the pictures again. This we'll post it in the show notes, but like when I showed you that, did you immediately also think like, what do those bones look like?
I just thought like, oh, Photoshop, oh, it can't be. Then I opened it. No, it's legit. Okay, it's a thing.
No, it's a big boy. And I was just like, oh man, I could probably murder someone with those bones. They're like huge and robust. I could probably use one as like a club.
But also very elongated because castrated.
Oh yeah, that is true. We'll have to do an episode on castration, I guess, huh?
Oh yeah, and to give a little bit of context for those who are not aware, castrated males in cattle, or just castrated animals in general, I guess, will tend to be larger, but more than larger per se, they'll be taller because their bones are like more elongated, because I guess it delays the fusion of the bones, so they sort of keep growing a little bit longer. correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the sciencey person here.
No, I believe that's right. I mean, to be honest, I don't really look at castration as much because honestly, I'm hit with like thousands and thousands of bone fragments. I can't.
But we'll probably get into that as we begin the episode. But just to give you like a little bit of context, you know, knickers is about 1.94 meters tall. And now usually the average or like the maximum height for aurochs, so like the ancestor of cattle, used to be about 1.80 meters tall. So this boy is bigger than an aurochs.
Yeah, because actually my partner was asking me when he was reading the story, he was like, oh, what would you think if you found those bones? And I was like, I would probably think it was like a weird auroch, to be honest. But as you said, it's even bigger than that, which is nuts. But more importantly, let's get into general cattle domestication.
Do you mean more importantly than knickers?
Yes, that is true. There is nothing more important. Oh, did you see that why his name is knickers?
No.
Because there's another cow named Bra, like Brahmin. So they have the whole underwear set. I could honestly do a whole episode on knickers. Oh my god, what a good cow. Part of me wants to like contact my supervisor at the university and be like, listen, I don't think I can do this PhD research anymore. I need to just do a whole thing on this cow. It's just huge. Please send me to Australia.
Funded research trip to Perth.
Oh, God.
To study knickers.
I just want to know more about that boy.
I'm just taught to study knickers.
That literally just hit me. It's been a day. But okay, Let's do it. We're going to talk about cattle in general. We can't always talk about Knickers as much as I want to talk about Knickers so much all the time. I want this to be the Knickers podcast. Oh, God.
We can always try and get a sponsor for like someone who sells underwear.
I specifically want Knickers the Cow to sponsor our podcast, to be honest. Wow, we haven't even hit 10 episodes yet and we're already falling apart.
Okay, so like back to cows. Okay, so cows belong to a very, very big family called the Bovidae. And the family includes cows, of course, but also bison, sheep, goat, deer, and antelope. But they're also part, within the family, of a super family, which is not Bovidae, but Bovinae, with an N. And the super family Bovinae only has two genera. So you have Bos, which includes the now gone extinct aurochs.
All right, okay.
Bison.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit of taxonomic background on the animals per se. And I think you've all seen a cow that they're pretty big, pretty happy. They like to just graze on stuff. And they do actually a fairly complex digestive system that allows them to process food like grass. I think because there's one of them, it's either cat or horse that have actually sort of two stomachs.
Is that thought it was cattle? It's hard because honestly, as someone who's like really hyper-focused on like zooarchaeology and scientific zooarchaeology, I generally don't know much about the living bits all the time.
Well, neither do I. My interaction to cows is limited by the field of lovely cows. They used to be in my village and I always used to say hello and they were very curious and they enjoyed a little stroke from me. But it's come to the time of the year where they've gone from the field and we don't say where they've gone to. We all know, but we don't say.
Yeah. Oh man, just a sidebar, but the most famous cows I've ever met are like 2 years ago I went to the Ben and Jerry's factory in Vermont and I met the cows there and it was amazing.
Ooh.
Yeah. Celebrity cows. They help make your Ben and Jerry's. Who knew? I knew. But yeah, anyway, so again, cattle is what when you find cattle, you're basically dealing with a domestic site, aren't you? For the most part.
Essentially, yeah. Although you may find the odd aurochs here and there. I don't know. Shall we mention a little bit about the history of like aurochs and domestication and.
Yeah, just a bit, I guess. I mean, I think at this point, everyone should kind of understand the general kind of ebb and flow of how the domestication process, but specifically with cows, I guess.
Yeah, because again, with domestication, it's not well understood when and where the aurochs was domesticated and became cattle. At present, it appears, as of when this is being recorded, the 28th of November, cattle was domesticated some just over 8,000 years ago in Southwest Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Although as far as from the information I could find about it, like one of the main markers that has actually been used is just the sudden increase of Bos sort of remains in domestic assemblages.
Yeah.
Because Bos are going by the genera name. So either these people were killing all the aurochs and taking them all back to the settlement, or they were up to something.
Who knows? But yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of the same story we get with most domestication, isn't it? We kind of have an idea, but it gets a bit fuzzy. It's a long time. We just know that we now have cattle.
I mean, there are some markers that sort of like could represent sort of a clear, definite. We found remains of a Bos, presumably most likely cattle in Cyprus, and of course, there's no native wild cattle in Cyprus, so they must have been transported there. So if they were not cattle per se, they would have been sort of very tame Auroxen, but someone brought them there. It's sort of the same story. Like, we'll get to that in a couple of episodes with one of the cat burials found in Cyprus. And of course, there's no wild cats in Cyprus originally. Yeah. So if we find any other cats in the archaeological record, someone brought them in. So it's, someone's let the cat out of the bag and all.
Basically, what we're trying to say, domestication cattle kind of go hoof and hoof, I guess that would be. That was a bad joke. I'm sorry. I'm going to leave the podcast now.
Well, actually, just as a little bit of information, because, of course, as many people know, the aurochs went extinct. Was a bit about the 17th century that the last one died in Poland?
I think so. I'm not an auroch person, per se. I deal mostly with cows, unfortunately. I don't think I've actually ever come across auroch bones before, which is...
I have not, no.
Disappointing.
But one sort of interesting thing with a side of ethics for you, which we may not necessarily have the time to get into, but it'll be an interesting thing for the listeners out there to like let us know what they think. Because in the 19th century, two brothers, the Heck brothers, who are zookeepers in Germany, decided that they wanted to bring the aurochs back.
Yeah.
So they actually got hold of sort of semi-wild cattle and modern domestic individuals, and they tried to selective breed them back to the aurochs. And now, of course, what they've achieved was an animal that looks an awful lot like an aurochs, about the same size, same colour, though can perhaps agree that even if it looks like an aurochs and it acts like an aurochs, it's not necessarily an aurochs. I also want that on a t-shirt. Which brings to a whole like debate that I made inside of my head. And now thanks to me, you can all make it inside of your head too. And you can curse me and thank me for it later.
Don't we all already?
Should we actually try and resurrect extinct animals?
I mean, you know, I would love to get mauled to death by like an auroch.
So yeah.
Can I interject really quickly here? No, you shouldn't want to bring back dead animals. I really disagree with that. Look, can we just point out, 1993, we found out that basically bringing animals back from the dead was a bad idea. Jurassic Park has nobody thought of that. That's what happens if you bring animals back. But to the bigger point is that if you do bring these animals back, a lot of the time they won't be the animals that were there in the past. You know, we've changed our environments so much that bringing these animals back, I don't think is really fair. And I also think, well, it's, you know, meddling with nature. And I think we're probably better trying to look after the animals that have survived rather than trying to bring dead ones back. I don't know. That's my opinion on this, but I might be wrong.
That's fine. It's actually explained it a lot better than I would have done, because I'm 100% in agreement with what Tristan said.
But that was a take so hot that the producer had to come in.
I'm also trying to steer you back into cows as well, because
that's completely fair.
I feel you've left the paddock a little. Oh, I'm just hurting. Gotta herd these podcasters.
Oh my god! Give me your location right now. I'm coming over, just beating you.
No, that's not going to happen. No,
not with that attitude.
Go back to cows. Go back to cows.
Okay, so.
But yes, if you have any ideas, opinions, just reply in the comments or tweet at us using the hashtag ArchaeoAnimals.
But yeah.
We'll have a nice debate somewhere where it is more fitting and we have more time.
So, identifying cattle bones. So now that we've already put out the fact that when you have a domestic assemblage, you're usually going to find cow bones. How do we actually identify them? I don't know about you, but I have a very bad habit of anytime I see any pretty big bones, I'm like, all right, that's a cow. And it takes me a second to like be like, you should probably double check that, Alex. Because it just seems so easy to just be like, if they're this size, they're probably cow.
Well, that's exactly the thing, because usually on a domestic assemblage, like 90% of what you're going to find is either going to be cattle or sheep. Mm-hmm. But now, because of course what you find in the archaeological record will tend to be a lot more fragmentary, and also we have this bias in our head that if there's something large-ish, it's likely to be cattle, we sometimes tend to overlook, like, not necessarily horse, but especially red deer. Mm. So something like, if you look at cattle, which of course, like back in prehistoric times, it used to be considerably smaller than it is these days.
Yeah.
It's not completely, you know, outside of the realms of possibilities to mistake cattle for red deer. And of course, the skeletons of the two animals are actually fairly similar, even though, like, you know, if you add the complete specimens in front of you, the differences are quite blatant. Mm-hmm. But then when you have very small remains of something that's roughly cattle-sized, you're more inclined to just put it down as cattle. And the same can happen to an extent with horse, but usually, like, yeah. Horse, if you do a double take, horse is so different. Of course, like, we're talking about postcranial elements, because with skulls and teeth, like, you can't really get it wrong, like cattle and horse. Because
I mean, I will say, in my to defend my bad zooarchaeology, I did just send some animal fragments out to get zooarchaeology by mass spectrometry done, and there was a bit that I was so convinced was a bit of cow, but it was so big I wanted to double check if it was auroch, and it was like a cranial bit. Turned out it was horse.
Well, but if it's a small cranial bone that you're not necessarily, I mean, if you have a complete skull, then it'll be very blatantly a horse.
Yeah.
And of course, the teeth are very different. So the cusps, they're a lot more pointy in cattle. Well, the horse tend to have this almost squared, well, not always, but most like square, chunky things.
Yeah.
And they're very long teeth. You can't miss it. We'll post some photos in the show notes. You can't miss them.
I mean, all animal teeth are bad, but yeah, definitely. All right, so we're going to take a bit of a break, and after that, we will talk a bit more about what cattle remains actually indicate in assemblages.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
Okay, and we're back talking about cows this episode. So now that we've kind of talked a bit about the ins and outs of the actual morphology of the cow bones, or at least we attempted to, we talked a lot about knickers. let's talk a bit more about kind of what we can extrapolate from cattle remains when we find them in assemblages. So kind of one thing that I wanted to talk about is that it's not unique to cattle, but I feel like you find it more with cattle. Pathologies related to domestication.
I guess because cattle were not the only animal used for traction, but I think they were sort of like the major one. So of course, like, yeah, with cattle, would be a lot more likely to find sort of bone growths like that.
Cattle pathologies relating to domestication. So yeah, I mean, cattle aren't, you know, the only animals used for traction, but I kind of, at least in my brain, I associate them mostly with having specific pathologies that you can relate immediately to domestication.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not massively knowledgeable in this department, but I think like spavin is the main one that comes to mind. It's just like this bone growth,
yeah,
in
that's
the,
what in I
the foot
of
bones. That is usually like, mm-hmm, it's been interpreted as being caused by incessant traction. So essentially it's a chronic inflammation of the joints of the foot bones.
Yeah. Am I mixing up horse, but can you also get like bit wear? I know you can find it in horse, but can you find it in cattle as well? Do you think?
I'm not sure. Because again, I'm not entirely sure what sort of plows they used.
True, yeah.
I feel like I should know, but I don't.
Yeah, this is something that I was very confident of, like, oh, cattle have that too. And now I'm just like, but do they? But I mean, I guess the general point, though, is that cattle do have kind of those pathologies that, especially if you're not really sure what kind of animal you're dealing with, you know, those things might help out with IDing.
Although I might be able to tell you more about, guess what, like some Iron Age and Roman information about cattle. You know, they can help us make interpretations about archaeological sites.
Ooh, do tell.
Yeah, right, my faves. Because one trend that is identified with cattle, especially in the Roman period, is that you tend to find a higher number of cattle in your assemblage on more Romanized sites as opposed to more sort of native Romano-British sites. So you like a lot more cattle and sort of what actual Roman sites, especially military, so like military forts, then just cattle everywhere. Pig, actually, more Romanized sites have a lot more pig as well, but that's a story for another day. And also the shift from the Iron Age to the Roman period sees an increase in size of cattle. Mm-hmm. And that's probably got something to do with the Romans bringing their own cows, as they did for essentially everything, like they've done with the fallow deer. Yes, we could hunt all the native deer that's already here, but no, we're going to bring the fallow deer from home because we want to hunt something we know, because Romans. And the butchery practices will shift as well, because up until the Iron Age period, in Britain at least, butchery would have still been carried largely on the ground and using a knife. So you'll find a lot of sort of small V-shaped cut marks on the bone.
Yeah.
Which like sort of implies that a knife has been mostly used. But then butchery sort of becomes more systematic as the Romans start colonizing.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have one feature that I particularly like myself for no particular reason is that you find holes in the center of the scapula of cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been interpreted as like to put a hook through, maybe to hung up the joint and smoke it.
Oh, okay.
Although like in the Romano-British period, carcasses were generally hung anyway, but I guess you wouldn't have been hung by the shoulder. And I'm actually, again, it's something I feel like I should know. When you've butchered an animal, where do you actually hang it from at the butchers? I've never really looked, I must say. They also started to bring in cleavers. And I sounded way too excited for that. But you start seeing the chop marks, yeah, that sort of you're all used to, like a proper, like nice and neat. That's the technical term for it.
Yeah, how do you spell that?
P-R-F-F-P-U. So yes, you get the chop marks, like a big one. They'll use it to separate the legs from the hip, so you'll actually they'll cut up the head of the femur with their cleaver and then just go yeah and separate the two. But just to mention something that isn't Roman for a change. Because, you know, like I mentioned with in the Roman period that you tend to find cattle or more like Romanized sites, but also especially on military sites.
Yeah.
You can also draw similar trends. Well, not similar, but like trends of this kind, but completely different. Later on, because in the Anglo-Saxon period instead, like you tend to find cattle mostly in rural settlements,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to urban.
Yeah.
Which in a way is a bit weird because you'd think that they'll keep the cattle in the rural settlement, then either butcher them or move them to the urban centre where they get butchered. But never mind that. So those were my 5 cents about Roman cattle.
You brought up something that I actually didn't even think about before we even did this episode, which is just kind of the butchery process of cattle, because it is very specific. And the fact that, like, because when you mentioned it, I was like, yeah, I actually don't know how they hang up cow either.
Cleavers. Sorry, cleavers again.
It's just one of those things that you just kind of don't really think about until you actually have to think about it, huh?
Just actually, it'd actually be something very interesting to look into, because I mean, when you're looking at cut marks sort of in a cat or any other domesticated sort of remains that you find that have butchery marks, it'll be interesting actually to see what a butcher would have to say about them in terms of the kind of marks that are left on the bone and what sort of cuts of meat would you go for and how do you actually separate a carcass? Because, of course, you know, thousands of years have gone by, but I'm pretty sure some of the techniques are probably largely unchanged. Like in terms of like how, like what types of joints people go for and how to separate the carcass.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of it being that different, say from the Roman period until now.
Yeah, no, definitely not. Like it should more or less be the same, but I've never actually really looked into it, but you're right. That is really interesting to think about.
So I'm just going to go weird out my local butchers and ask, like, how do you butcher this animal? Where'd you have? Show me where you cut it.
Can you record that for me? I'd love a video. But yeah, no, I mean, the fact that, you know, now cattle are used in food as well as in the domesticated setting is the reason why we kind of associate, not just zooarchaeologically, we associate cattle with domesticated assemblages, but even if you look in the material remains of the archaeological record, you can even see that, like, again, my area of interest research-wise is more like later prehistoric, so Neolithic, Iron Age, things like that. And in the Iron Age, you see a lot of domestic items that have cattle on it. Like, one of the things I always think of is like, what's it called? It's like something that goes over the hearth. I can't remember what it's called now, of course. There's one that is that's been found that has like cattle heads on them, like pots, stuff like that. You find that a lot, that it's so associated that it becomes a kind of decorating trope, I guess.
So like over the hearth, so like does it have a specific function, is it just something purely decorative that they found?
I think it's something functional now. It's like completely slipping out of my mind. But I know like there's cauldrons, pots, things like that that also have like cattle emblazoned on them, or you know, images of cattle on them, which again just kind of really iterates the fact that they are seen as a very domestic type animal, which makes sense. I mean, based on just everything we've just talked about. But
so I guess the least we mention about the ancient Greeks' fascination with bulls, the better, probably.
Yeah, that's good. That's fine. We're good. But
so ancient Greece, bulls everywhere.
Oh god,
and that just sounded like I said something else.
It did for a second. It took me a bit. Oh god, the Mycenaeans, man. But it's not just domestication. We could also talk about the fact that cattle can be used in more cool, ritually type, abstract sort of thingamabobs, whatever you want to call it.
I feel like we should get a sound bite for it, like ritual.
I mean, that's basically how archaeologists kind of think about it, isn't it? It's a very scary, terrifying word.
I guess depending on the way you look at it, I guess that will be for another episode.
Well, cattle is like this thing where, like, if you look at if you're familiar with kind of like the later prehistoric British discourse, I guess, in archaeology, there's this whole thing of like the idea of, you know, the sacred versus the profane. Were they very separate spheres? But we have proof that clearly there was ritual elements in the domestic sphere. So, you know, yada, 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 stuff like that. So cattle were kind of like that in between. If you had a Venn diagram of like sacred and like regular stuff, cattle were kind of right in the middle, because again, there are those domestic connotations, but they also use cattle in, you know, a ritual here and there. The one that I can always think of, not necessarily ritual but more of a funerary thing, is when I used to dig up in Swandro in the Orkney Islands, which is all the way at the top of Scotland for anyone who doesn't know. One of the first animals I actually ever dug up was a more or less articulated cow that had been buried underneath the floor of a building, of a Pictish building. So that's about Iron Age.
My thing was, I love me a good foundation deposit.
Oh, I do love foundation deposit. But like that was so cool. And again, it just kind of solidifies that idea of like, oh, it's a liminal space. It's kind of ritual, kind of domestic. I love the word liminal. It's the best word ever.
Yeah. But of course, I mean, in that case, of course, it doesn't seem very accidental at all that a cow ended up in the foundations of a building. But of course, we do get a fair amount of articulated cattle burials in Britain.
Yeah, we do.
Because I've been, like, one of the main texts that I've read through, like, is Morris's publication, Investigating Animal Burials. Mm-hmm. Ritual, Mundane, and Beyond.
Ooh.
So it's a tome of a book, and it's really interesting. So if anyone's really into, like, animal bone groups or ABGs, and just as well as complete skeletons, that's your go-to book. Because, it does mainly look at purely just Yorkshire and the south of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a very comprehensive piece of research.
Yeah.
It was great. I had a lot of fun going through it. I actually ended up reading it from cover to cover, but that's me sort of sidetracking everywhere like I always do. From what I've read, in the south of Britain alone,
mm-hmm.
There are 14 complete individuals total have been recorded in the south of England.
Oh.
That's for the late Iron Age. Wow. Out of the 99 recorded in total. But one very good point that the author makes is that people tend to, they see a complete burial, a complete skeleton of a cow in a pit or wherever. And you think, oh, but like, surely, that's not very practical. If a cow dies or if you kill a cow, you're going to eat it. Why are you not eating it? So that's sort of where your mind thinks, oh, was it a cherished pet? Or maybe was it ritual because of this whole cow, buried in a pit? But then if you think about it, I mean, what would people think hundreds of years down the line when they find all the pits that have all the cattle that died of foot and mouth disease buried in there?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a very good reason why they weren't eaten. Mm-hmm. So actually, that was a very good point that was made by the author. And because sometimes, of course, like, it's all nice and good to find a nice, pretty piece of ritual. But at the same time, chances are usually the more mundane interpretation is likely the correct one. Or maybe I'm just a disenchanted archaeologist that's been doing this for too long.
I think we're opposites in that effect, but because my research is specifically on funerary rites and ritual, everything I see is like ritual now.
You haven't dug in the cold in the winter for 4 years.
No, sorry, I haven't.
Don't. It's not fun. Bring the archaeologist inside. Offer us a cup of tea, please.
Especially if you just dug up a cow, because they are usually big and annoying, but not that bad because the bones are usually robust enough that you don't accidentally break them like I may or may not have done to a bunch of fish bones up in Scotland.
Unless the soil is very acidic, in which case
true. You
look, you clean around the shadows and you see what shape it makes. But back to cattle burials. I think my favorite one, if I can say that at all, but one that particularly struck me that I found interesting that was also mentioned in the text that I was talking about earlier, mm-hmm. was one that was found in Dorset in Gossage All Saints. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing that
correctly. Yeah. I think that's how I'd pronounce it.
Which is, of course, known because of all the kiddies, but we'll get to that later. What I did not know is that they found a burial of an adult cow with a neonate cow that was halfway down the pelvic cavity.
Ugh.
So, like, you get with human remains, you get coffin births.
Yeah.
It is like that, but with a cow.
How is that? Why does that seem so much worse?
But birth is a beautiful thing, just maybe not when you're already dead.
Ugh, well, that seems like a great place to take another break. Just leave everyone thinking about, death. And I mean, I guess technically our whole podcast is about death, isn't it?
A little bit.
Just noticed that, I guess. Okay, we will take another break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a couple more case studies of some of our favorite dead cows. A cheerful podcast.
Yeah.
Yay.
Cleavers!
This network is listener-supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. Are you tired of the webinars and training offered by the big organizations not being free for members and not really covering what we need? Team Black has the answers. Check out arccert.black/main for our upcoming webinar schedule. All of our webinars happen once a month and seating is limited. Learn everything from field tech basics to drones to digital workflows. We have more classes coming online every month. Classes are always 1 hour and cost just $20. Classes like building a CV and getting a job are always free. That's right. We'll help you get a job, then we'll be here when you want to level up your skills. If you are a professional subscriber to the APN at arcpodnet.com/members, then you get all of Team Black's offerings for free as part of your membership. We have Team Black memberships coming that will give the same for the APN. So $20 a month gets you all the APN swag and extras, plus free training from Team Black. So check out arccert.black for more information and level up your skill set today. That's arccert.black. Now back to the show.
Okay, and we're back. I hope everyone spent their break thinking about casket births and death, because we're cheerful and fun, and that's why everyone listens to this podcast.
Invite us to your next party.
Exactly. But so now, you know, it's time for everyone's favorite part of this podcast, when we talk about specific case studies that we definitely did tons of research on. But I mean, we did talk a little bit about some specific case studies before, but I'm here to talk about one that I actually think about all the time, which is these cow what
sorry, okay. could you say that you think about it all the time, and it just in my mind it just popped that meme of sort of like of the guy that can't get to sleep,
and then
be like, well, is it thinking about something else? No, I'm just thinking about that cow burial. I just can't get it out of my head.
Sorry, but this one's so cool. Like, I think it's so cool to me. But there's a Viking Age feasting hall that was found in Iceland, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Hofstadir? I think.
Hofstadir?
Yeah.
This would have been a good point to have Albina back.
I know, right? But this one I always remember because I originally was going to specialize in Viking Age archaeology, so I remember, like, reading about this a lot. But so it's a feasting hall, and one of the things that they found was like loads of cattle skulls that upon further investigation were mass slaughtered and probably hung up as decor, I guess, on the outside of the feasting hall.
That's my kind of party.
Yeah, see, like, I always think of that, because I was like, that is a great vibe. I would love that at my house. I'm thinking about it for our new house that we're moving into. Like, that's so cool, but, you know, it's just so cool. I'm sorry, I'm not saying anything educational, I just think it's super cool.
Good, go on.
Specifically because it's...
Off you go. Off you go. Go butcher 23 cows. Send me photos.
But like just that image of having all those cow heads, you know, just kind of, you know, tastefully placed outside of a feasting hall. I mean, this site is kind of known for being a very big hotspot for pagan activity at the time. So you think it's something to do with that, along those lines. But I mean, come on. That's so cool.
Yeah, and I think like one thing that I was reading about is that they had a very unusual butchery on them.
Yeah, they did. Those skulls were just very strange in general. Like, it was weird butchery characteristics, but also like the taphonomic characteristics were also quite strange, which is why I think, at least in my mind, this is like probably one of the more famous cow remains that have been found in archaeology. You know, out of all those other many famous cow remains that we've found in archaeology that everyone knows. But yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like we had to just mention that one at least because, one, it's cool. Two, it's going to be the album cover of my next metal band album. And, and you know, I think it also kind of ties in that thing we were talking about in the last segment of how cows are this kind of liminal space of domesticity and ritual activity, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, just...
You're just not that excited about ritual like I am. I understand.
I am very excited about ritual, just sort of equally disenchanted by it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it doesn't have to always be ritual. Like, the article that we'll link in the show notes specifically has it called, like, a ritual decapitation display at a Viking settlement. I mean, it could just be that they wanted to decorate with a bunch of dead cows. You know, no judgment, right?
That could be, I mean, the cattle that you've killed for that one particular feast. I don't know. How many guests were invited?
True. We didn't. I don't know if they found a guest list, but I can always look into that. But I just realized that the case studies that I have listed, they all have to do with, like, horrible things happening to skull, cow skulls. Just couldn't pick anything nice happening. Well, the other case study that I had, unless you have anything else to add about the cool Icelandic cow decorations.
Go ahead. Is that the French cow?
Yeah. So this one I definitely wanted to talk about because it happened this year. They found these Neolithic cow skull, or a Neolithic cow skull that had a hole in it in France that they think is I'm gonna pronounce this right. Trepanation?
Trepanation or trepanning? Trepanation.
Yeah. I've never said that word out loud. I mean, why would I ever say that word out loud? So, you know, it's a learning experience for all of us.
Yeah, do it in a way, I'm sort of cheating because trepanation, that's from the Latin. Because that's incredibly close to the Italian word for a drill. So it makes an awful lot of sense.
Okay. But so yeah,
I kind of cheat with that, like in taxonomic, like scientific, like species names. I kind of cheat a little bit.
That's pretty unfair. But yeah, so they found this cow skull that had a pretty sizable hole. And the archaeologist that found it, I think that has something to do with kind of experimentation in cranial surgery, which is a very interesting interpretation. I mean, personally, I don't think I would have been able to make that interpretation myself, but
so I find it very confusing because, of course, I know trepanation was carried out a lot on people. And I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I remember like reading about it and seeing a few photos, but I don't remember what the size of the actual hole was. But you'd think for trepanation, it would have been something relatively small.
Yeah, they said it was the size of like a biscuit, which is, you know, not helpful whatsoever.
What type of biscuit?
Yeah, there's so many other types of biscuits.
Is a cookie, a bowl, and a custard cream?
Yeah, exactly. Like for the American listeners, we are talking about cookies and not Southern biscuits. Just gonna point that out. But yeah, the idea was that the archaeologist who, the lead archaeologist in this basically said, oh, you know, I've looked at trepanation in human skulls and it's the same technique because there's a bit of scraping that they found around the hole. So yeah, that's apparently how they came up with that interpretation, which is kind of wild.
Okay, I didn't know about the scraping that was found on this particular skull. I mean, of course, the one thing that we know is that there's no signs of healing, so it was already pretty dead or died soon after.
Yeah.
But the thing that confused me the most is that you do actually find an awful lot of cattle skulls with holes very similar to that, and there's a much more mundane explanation for that. Poleaxe.
Yeah, see, that's exactly what I wanted to bring it up, because we will also include this in the show notes, but in my lab, at least, we actually have a Iron Age cow skull that has been completely obliterated by a poleaxe. It's definitely a sizable hole, but when I first heard about the story, that's exactly what I thought of, was like, are we sure it's not, you know,
poleaxe? Because that was the go-to, like, in the time period, like, sort of adds up. And 3000 BC, that would have been, I don't know, well, Bronze Age-y, late Neolithic sort of thing. But still, like, so, like, at least in the Iron Age, so the go-to dispatching method is, like, poleaxe, just, again, the very scientific...
Exactly, yeah. No, and, you know, the fact that it's in the skull, I mean, that's a killing blow right there. Like, it makes sense why that it would be there. But apparently the two main theories for this was either they were practicing trepanation to then do onto humans, or they were trying to do trepanation on the cow specifically to save the cow.
That's so much hassle, though.
Exactly. No, I think the authors even say that, where they're like, probably not, because, you know, you would just eat it as long as it wasn't, you know, dying of some kind of disease. So that seems unlikely. But even still, you know,
yeah, I'm kind of suspect. I should elaborate. I'm exactly the kind of person who would go through that hassle to save any living creature. But in the mindset of someone that has to be very practical about the way they go with their lives and the things that they do, like, you probably wouldn't go through that much effort to save a cow.
Yeah.
Unless it was, like, your only cow and your most prized possession and your beloved pet.
True. I mean, one thing I will say, because obviously I'm not rejecting this hypothesis, because I don't know enough about trepanation to actually have a good, you know, clean statement about this, but I will say what I'm learning as I work more on ritual assemblages, and specifically how people treated humans versus animal remains, there's kind of not really that much of a difference in a lot of cases. So I guess I wouldn't be surprised if that turned out to actually be the truth. Not that we could find out truly, but you know what I mean.
Especially because of the scrape marks. Of course, if you deliver a killing blow with a poleaxe on a cattle, why are you going to go and fiddle with it and scrape it with something? What's the point?
Exactly. And actually, this article that we're going to link in the show notes actually specifically talks about how trepanation has been debated, as it might also have been part of rituals. So once again, cows and rituals. I'm never gonna not die on this hill, Simona, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Oh, you know, bulls with big horns, fertility symbol. The fertility goddess, sacrifice it. Okay.
Listen, I like my zooarchaeology as abstract and conceptual as possible, so... But yeah, no, so these are probably, I would argue these are probably the two biggest cow cases that the archaeology world has come across.
In archaeology, because if we take the whole of history together, then that would be knickers.
Ugh, yes, knickers. I'm so jealous of the zooarchaeologists that are going to come across knickers. Can you imagine? Like, okay, so we have a bit of time, so let's make our last case study be the hypothetical future moment where Knickers, the giant steer, is found. Like, can you imagine how much of a big deal that it is, literally and figuratively?
Yeah, but although, like, will social media preserve hundreds of years down the line?
I want to be that. No, see, that's the thing. I want to be that zooarchaeologist who finds Knickers, goes, oh my God, look at this giant. I guess people might think that Knickers was an auroch because of how big he is.
That, or like, oh, they're going to, you know, like, find a link on the old web and think, oh no, that's so 2018.
No, but then you find the textual evidence of, apparently this giant cattle was like a big deal, truly worshipped among memers. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, but what if the memes are the only thing that's left? You know, imagine you didn't have any of the actual reporting done and you just literally had the memes. I mean, this is the real archaeology here. Like the archaeology of memes. That's what I want.
I believe.
Then I guess they'll dub this time the new Dark Ages.
How dare you? I love a good meme.
Actually, I had some questions, because you guys were talking about ritual quite a lot, and then you talked a little bit about domestication. I mean, obviously, the use of domesticated cattle obviously had different uses. Now, in the archaeological record, do we see the difference between cows being used for meat, cows being used as beasts of burden, cows being used for milk? I mean, are there ways in which we're not just delineating between animal for work or meat and ritual? Is there a more fine grain pieces of evidence that we see as well?
I mean, I think then that comes down to more of the general characteristics of the bone. Because, you know, if you're looking at butchery, usually you're looking at post-meal butchery, aren't you? Or post-butchery. So you'll see cut marks, the things like that, the fine cut specifically. Like, you have like manuals like Binford. Lewis Binford has a great manual on butchery recording that I'm actually using right now, where specifically, like, if you find a cut like this here, then it was probably used for dismemberment. If you found a cut here, this was used for skinning. It's fantastic. But yeah, I guess that's kind of where you get to the nitty gritty, isn't it? Of kind of figuring out, okay, if this is like, how did they use this cow?
But also one thing that I would personally bring up is actually looking at the age of death.
True, yeah.
Because of course, by looking at the fusion of the bones and especially at the tooth wear, you can age the animals within your assemblage and then have what's like called, I believe, like an age of death sort of profile.
Yeah.
So if you see that you have in your assemblage a vast majority of very old animals, chances are they were used as beasts of burden. So they were kept alive literally as long as possible so they could farm the land.
Exactly.
Then, of course, for butchery, so for meat purposes, you'll tend to find sub-adult animals. So like that adults, but not quite.
Because you get them at their prime, so, you know.
Exactly, because I guess if you kept them until adult age, they would grow a little bigger. But I guess the amount of food and hassle, like it wouldn't necessarily be worth the marginal increase in size. And I guess the meat wouldn't taste as good either.
Yeah.
And then for milk, I think it's like if you find a high percentage of juveniles.
Yeah.
Because then, of course, you'll cull, like, especially the males, so then you can get the milk from the cows.
Yeah, and you can add that with isotopic information, I think, as well, looking at dairying and stuff like that, which is stuff, of course, that I don't necessarily know off the top of my head, but I know generally that's what you do.
But I guess if you got the funding for that as well. Yeah. Otherwise, it's the good old, like... Otherwise, it's the good old like little graphs, like and looking at tooth wear and comparing, and assigning age classes to your specimens in your good old long-winded way,
and then you cry forever.
So basically, on the Christmas wish list, Santa, I really want some isotopic analysis for these remains, please.
Have you been reading my private documentation? Because I basically just asked for that.
I mean, I having a background in chemistry and archaeology, you know, isotopes is like, oh, yeah, that's normal. I can do that. I don't have an isotope analysis machine, but I mean, like, how costly can it be? Really? Come on, let's just, GoFundMe. How about that?
Let's
start with Archaeanimals GoFundMe for isotopic analysis.
I mean, I could do it. I've done it with fish. I assume it's the same stuff you do with cows.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, no, it is probably it. The only difference between, I guess, the bone densities are different, but that's your area, not mine.
Unfortunately,
how the things go running the machine, I can tell you about. But once it's the bones, that's completely different.
I mean, I'd rather just give you the bones, to be honest. I don't really want to do it.
Oh, fine. All right. Post them over my way. Yeah. I'm sure. Oh, that'd be great. Could you imagine like putting bones in the post, like cow bones in the post, and like somebody in a, like somewhere in Royal Mail, somebody opens it up and thinks, oh, can you actually post bones? I don't know. This is one to you.
You can. I mean, it gets kind of dicey. Like, I just posted loads of bones to Oxford, and I was told to tell the mailing department in the university that it's archaeological materials and nothing else.
That'd be a good point for like you to share your story of the chicken in the mail.
Oh, okay. So what you can do is you can straight up send a completely dead animal, just a dead animal, because I've been sent a chicken that hasn't been processed into bones.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I got sent a chicken. A friend of ours, Allison, who does chicken stuff. Well, she does a lot of others in archaeology, but she was cleaning out her fridge and she was like, do you want a chicken? And I was like, yeah, I would love it for my reference collection. So she just sent over a dead chicken in the mail. It was amazing.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's, wow. That kind of definitely, wow. And you were fine with that?
Yeah.
See, that's the weird part for me. You were like, oh yeah, I'll take a chicken in the mail.
It's because I'm not a coward.
Let's not have a P.O. box for Arceo animals. I
please, no. Oh, let's have a P.O. box. I need to build up my reference collection. So if anyone wants to send me all the dead animals, please do. It'd be great. My partner won't like it, but I will.
I guess, no, I think with bones, I think, no, it's absolutely fine to send in the mail, I believe. I think the issue is only when you're sending outside of the EU. So they're being sent overseas, then there's all sort of forms and things that you need to fill in, yeah. I believe. So I've never exactly sent people bones. But
well, I'm trying to figure out because someone actually has a sheep skull for me in America. So I'm trying to figure out how to get that over here.
Oh, easy. Just go through the TSA, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as long as it's not Kinder Eggs, it's fine.
Excuse me, this is part of my religion.
Excuse me, this is my friend. This is my emotional service animal.
Oh dear, this is my comfort skull.
I need I have a doctor's note. I need it, I'll freak out.
I think like it should be fine. It's just like that you might have to pay customs for it when it gets here. It's not like a thing from the US. And again, like, I'm not awfully sure myself. I think it just gets a little bit more complicated depending on the species that you want to send over.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Alex, you want to wrap this episode up then?
Yeah, sure. All right. I think that does it for another episode of Archaeo Animals. As you know, you can always tweet us any of your questions at Archaeo Animals on Twitter or use the hashtag Archaeo Animals, and you know, we'd love to hear your feedback and stuff like that. And please send us all the bones of cows, because I don't have any in my reference collection.
Cleavers. Thank you for listening to Archaeo Animals. Please subscribe and rate the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. You can find us on Twitter at Archaeo Animals. Also, the views expressed on the podcast are those of ourselves, the hosts and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of our institution, employers and the Archaeology Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Don't make a P.O. box. Come on. You know what's going to happen. You're going to get like hamsters sent to you in the mail.
Oh my God, that would be great. I don't actually know what a hamster skeleton looks like, so I'd love that.